Hi, everyone, and welcome to Total Education Hour. It's going to be a fun conversation tonight. And first, I want to welcome the program, as I have to get him on the line, is the guy that, you know, has been around some time now and really getting into education, understanding it. Let's see if we got him on the line. It's Peter Albich. Peter, how are you?
I'm doing great. Ready for a great Total Education Hour tonight and ready to get a good topic.
Exactly. And what we're really going to work into the first two segments is how to get along with your teacher. So with your teenager. And I never could get around along with my teacher. And so I'm excited to welcome the program, Dr. Philip Agrios. Dr. Philip, thanks for calling. And I'm excited to talk about how to get along with your teenager, because we're seeing more and more these battles that we're dealing with in the classroom and also at home with teenagers. How are you?
I'm doing great, Neil. Thanks so much for inviting me on the show.
Absolutely. So let's kind of go delve into what is a big concern when it comes to dealing with teenagers, especially, boys or girls. In so many ways, and the challenges, and once they reach that teen year.
Yeah, a lot of times we've never been teenagers, so we don't know anything about that, right? and then sometimes we go back to the old ways of saying, well, when I was a teenager, and that's the last thing a teenager wants to hear about when you were a teenager, because they don't think that you're old. And you don't know what you're talking about. And I have two children, okay? They're 20 and 25. They're two girls. And so I've gone through many different experiences with them, as you can say. And as I was going through, especially a divorce, it's very tough, because especially as a father, and you try to do what you have to do, and a lot of times you compromise what you really need to do as a parent because you don't want to be disconnected from them. Maybe you're not seeing them as much, and it causes those problems. But even if you're in a loving relationship with your spouse, and you can go and have problematic situations with your teenager. So it doesn't really – sometimes it goes with what the parents are doing, but sometimes it doesn't. It's just sometimes kids just make stupid mistakes. You know, we don't realize that their frontal cortex, which is their reasoning, isn't really as developed as ours. And, you know, sometimes we don't get our stuff together, and we're expecting these kids who's been around for only 12, 13 years, right, to understand what they really should do. And that's one of the things you've got to realize, is that the teenagers are going to look for ways to numb themselves, just like we numb ourselves as well. And that's where you have to look at, are my kids doing very similar things that I'm doing?
And Peter, what we're going to put you on this today topics with our two guests is more of questions. So what questions do you have for Dr. Philip?
Well, you know, and something I was thinking about is kind of like the differences between generations. Really, when you're looking at, like, for instance, a generation that had less technology versus a generation now that has more technology, like, what major differences are you seeing, or is there more so similarities, just that there's a new piece of technology or new way of doing things that's been implemented into, so to speak, the daily routine of teens?
Well, there's a lot of new research coming out is that they're more disconnected because they're now focused more on this device that's in their hand that makes their brain, you know, kind of they're addicted to it, you know, and even many adults are being addicted to that aspect of it. And one of the things that you can really try to understand about your children is, what are their basic personality? There are different things that I discovered, and one of the things that they're actually just three basic traits. And one of the traits that we have is what I call your sabotaging trait. And that sabotaging trait is usually what causes us to go awry in different decisions that we shouldn't make, and especially teenagers.
Interesting. So sabotaging trait. So it develops at that hormonal stage in a teenager, it sounds like, Dr. Philip?
No. Actually, what I found is that we're born with it. It's essential to our being. Without it, we don't exist. You have to think that we think at sabotaging as we undermining ourselves. But sabotage is really looking at, and that's what the original word is, was for sabotage was to tell workers in France back in the 1890s to slow down and create inefficiencies so they can have a bargaining chip against the factory owners. I use it in that way because our sabotaging trait is essential for our growth to evolve or dissolve through fear. And by the sabotaging trait allows us to actually create inefficiencies so that we can see that there are imbalances in our lives. So those stresses that we have can be benefits if you look at it that way, or detriments if you look at it that way either. Many things that's happening are just really neutral. It's based on how we perceive that particular situation. How many times have you had good situations really turn that they were really not that great for you and vice versa? So many times by looking at things at more of a neutral way, you can really see where your perception is and what decisions you may cause you to have favorable or unfavorable consequences.
Interesting,
you know, and,
Peter.
And something else, you know, so that I was thinking of too in that aspect is because we have that trait, and do you find that going into our teen years, because I know it can go either way depending on the person and the circumstances, things like that. Do you find that more so created based around the experiences of like looking up, so to speak, to parental units or to like, you know, teachers, things like that? Or do you find that it's more so of a choice variable where they can choose, you know, so to speak, their own paths? Or does it really depend upon the situation?
It depends on how they're looking at life and whether or not they feel they have to please somebody and therefore they will not value their own opinion. That's one of the traits. Another one is they're so scattered, they're all over the place that they can't really, they don't like authority. They don't like to be told what to do. So they're kind of unfocused. They try one thing and then they don't finish one project and they have like 15 things going on. They have a lot of chaos in their lives. Or the other one is that they're not really expressive. They're kind of quiet. They sit back, they analyze. But you never know what they're thinking because they're kind of quiet and they're too fearful to express themselves because they don't want to look stupid or feel embarrassed. So depending on how their upbringing is will depend on how they will create them, what avenues they'll take to offset that. So maybe now the person who is not that expressive now really goes into more of a deep depression because that's how they protect themselves. Because you've got to realize there's only two things we do. We protect or we grow. That's it. And when if you and I have an argument, I'm just protecting myself from you.
How do we kind of train our teenagers to not use that trait?
First of all, by you actually understanding what that trait is, I actually created a 9-question quiz on my website that in under a minute you can find out your sabotage trait. And what I did was I also discovered the antidote. It's the exact opposite that will actually switch off your sabotage trait instantly at your will. And I've worked this with thousands of patients and people that I've looked at over the last 27 years. I started looking at it, and that's how long it's taken me to really develop it. And once you can understand what and who that person is that you've given birth to, and they're different children, right? You have three children, and three can all have different personalities. And by actually knowing them, you can now use their antidote to help them and guide them and support them in the way they need to be supported, not in the way you think they need to be supported, which is really how you need to be supported.
You know, and I was thinking upon the idea of the sabotage trait, does it change, for instance, you know, like let's say the generation before got the same one and then the current generation has the same one. Is it something that is always going to remain the same amongst progressive generations, or can it possibly change in that aspect if, let's say, you have more than one, you have more than one kid, you know, whether boy, girl, both girls, but have different sabotage traits. Is that possible, or have you seen it to be more so consistent unless there's, like, some sort of major deviant change?
I just find that, well, basically, there's only three basic sabotaging traits that I found. Okay, that's who we are. And by you coming, what I've seen is that we have one trait that we're born with. And when I first discovered this, I was on my living room floor, and I looked to my left, and that was a representation of my past. And I went, oh, my God, all those major things and all these things that I went through, I could have avoided some of those with my antidote. But with the other ones, I couldn't have avoided, but I would have had much favorable outcomes if I used my antidote. And then I looked at my right, which was my future, and I went, wait a minute. I can actually predict my future. When I get stressed, it's my antidote that's really telling me something's awry. And by using my antidote, I can neutralize it. And I said to myself, it can't be this simple. And I went out to try to disprove it because it was just too simple. And I didn't say it was easy. Right, two different things, mm-hmm. right? Not simple, easy. And then I started really working it, and I started using it with my own children and understanding how and why they were going through the situations and why they were, mad at me, whatever. And I started utilizing it, and I realized one thing. And I tell this no matter who it is, whether it's to your children or to whomever. You're not you're responsible to your children. You're not responsible for them. Now, let me explain that, if I may.
Exactly, yes.
Responsible to them is that you need to clothe them, you have to feed them, you have to do all that stuff, teach them and things like that. But you're not there to take their pain away. You're not there to overly protect them. So you're taking the brunt. Then of course you don't go to the other extreme where you're not responsible to them at all, and now you just let them go and you don't guide them. There's always that balance. And when people really realize that they're not really responsible for anybody except for themselves, then you pull back on the children. And I started seeing my kids respond differently. I have really phenomenal relationships with my kids, just amazing. And it was mainly because one day when they did something, quote, wrong, instead of me going, are you kidding me? Because I'm Greek and Italian. I was born Catholic. I was weaned on guilt, and, I got my butt kicked, okay? And I just said to them, I said, so how'd that work for you? And they just looked at me and said, no, it didn't work out well. I said, well, do you think you want to do that again? And they go, no. I said, well, do you want to hear what I may suggest that you might want to do to offset that? And sometimes they said yes, and sometimes they said no, and that was cool with that. You got to let them go and hit the wall.
Exactly. All right, so when we get back, we're going to continue the conversation with Dr. Philip. We're going to kind of go into really some of the thinkings. Let's just talk about teachers. How are teachers going to deal with teenagers? And the best way, especially in middle school and high school, and then also parents. Two ways, some strategies to implement for parents who listen to the show and teachers who listen to the show. You're listening to Total Education Hour at 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. When we get back, more with Dr. Philip and Peter Alvage. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Total Education Hour at 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. I'm with Peter Alvage and Dr. Philip Agrios. And we're really having a really interesting conversation regarding teenagers and also the sabotage trait. But let me delve into specifically enough. We talk about the trait. We talk about how we can help it in certain ways. But what about teachers now? Teachers sometimes are not as forgiving with what teenagers do. What responses should teachers show students, especially teenagers, when they're acting up, when they're being disrespectful, when they're lying, whatever they're doing?
It's a great question, and what's really interesting, just last week I just had a conversation with a friend of mine who's a teacher, and we were talking about how he responded to his kids and things like that. And he basically, when he would start with every class the first day, he would basically tell them and say, look, if you are stupid enough to tell me that you are going to commit suicide, or you're going to do this, or you're going to be doing this, I'm going to report you. I am governed by law by that. However, if you want to talk, whatever the case may be, I'm here. If not, that's okay. It's not my business, because I'm not here to tell you what to do. If you want to talk, that's great. If not, that's cool too, and go from there. And what he found was that kids would then come to him, because he wasn't trying to be the authoritarian. He basically said, I don't believe I should tell you what to do, but I'm here to teach you, and you go from there. And I said to him, yes, that's the perfect example of if you chase, they flee, and if you flee, they chase.
And I'm thinking of that dynamic, like from the sense of being in my own high school years and being a teenager myself. And I really find that when it comes to teachers and when it comes to students, you know, whether it be they're handling, you know, emotional issues, whatever it might be, you know, issues with studies, all that sorts of different things. I find that in that particular scenario, communication is 100% like has to be there, whether it be on either side. And of course, obviously, as it is, it's difficult because, like you said, you know, if you approach, you know, they might not respond. And if they approach, you know, the teacher might not necessarily know, you know, what to do. But I have found generalistically, from my own experiences as well as friends' experiences, that as much communication as possible is best between the two circumstances of student and teacher. However, I will say this in particular is because we're getting more so into technical advancements, I'm seeing more so of direct contact being placed on a different day or maybe a different time frame, you know, versus like, you know, you just go to detention today and we'll talk to you tomorrow kind of thing. I think in that particular, you know, like putting it off or, you know, basically sending an email or whatever it is, where it isn't direct communication for either the student or the teacher to vocalize, I think is also hindering the ability to, you know, for instance, communicate and handle teens in the classroom. But that's just at least my point of view. But my thought is when we're looking at, you know, teenagers and we're looking at, you know, communication amongst, you know, students and then connecting with teachers, what would you suggest, like, let's say if there's a student right now that is curious about approaching the teacher and communicating with them, but is not sure how to or if it would be the best thing, what would you recommend to them so that there could be more of an open channel to communication?
Recommendation to the teacher or recommendation to the student?
To the student.
Oh, to the student. Is to basically to look at them that exactly what the teacher was telling you. Yes, he in that position is an authoritarian, okay? Authoritarian as in a guiding, not as a dictator.
Right.
And many teachers, you know, we've all had them, you know, where they would just take on the parent role and some others would just don't give a darn and give the easiest test, which doesn't help them either. It's always looking for that balance. And if the student comes up to that teacher, he's going to have to realize what kind of person, who's that person? Are they really going to talk to other people? Can I really talk with them? And by then, just slowly giving some easy questions or easy, you know, I'm having this and this. And even if see how the response of the teacher is. If they're kind of like, well, very quick and whatever, then they know they're not going to be able to really sit down and talk to them about really major problems. And then from there, the teacher would then guide them to the guidance counselor or psychologist and things like that. But it's an open portal from there. But I think a lot of teachers are very open and giving. That's why they're there, and they're very approachable. There's only a few teachers that I know aren't. But the majority, and I've had a lot of patients that were teachers, they are open to that. And if the child just gives them a chance, then they can see what type of communication they can have with that, as long as it's a balanced thing.
And that balance. So overreaction is a big no-no with teenagers, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, because, again, we're going to the extremes from, you know, you did this, and now you're going to – I call it catastrophizing. You know, oh, my God, you're going to do this, and now you're going to be on the tower shooting people, you know, or this and that. You know, let's just take it for the present-day moment. Let's focus on what's going on with that person. You know, why are they numbing themselves? And that's the whole thing. You know, why the girl cuts herself? Because it's less painful than dealing with the situation she's got to deal with or he has to deal with. So
I want to interrupt this because I really want to talk about, let's just talk about cutting or a certain self-injurious behavior. Why is it they don't want to deal with the situation? What's internally in their brain that they don't want to deal with, that they'd rather hurt themselves like cutting themselves instead?
It's anybody. You know, it's the adult coming home and drinking 3-4 glasses of wine or going smoking cigarettes or yelling at the kids or beating, whatever the case may be. What I find is that people, to be successful, it's more painful to be successful, whether it's being more healthy, dealing with their problems. It's actually more painful than staying where they're at. And that's what they have to realize, is that it's an illusion. It's really an illusion. It just is. It's how many times you thought something that you had to do was the worst thing ever, and you finally did, and you realize it wasn't that bad. So it's an illusionary thing. It's dealing with perception and what happened to them previously. They might have been, you know, maybe their parent, they every time they go to an adult, they get, you know, yelled at, or they get more pain. So why would they do that? So every adult possibility is that painful situation. So they link that pain to that person, even though that person didn't do a thing to them.
You know, wow. And I was thinking too, because I've unfortunately I've had experiences with some friends with different scenarios. I'm not going to say what, but what I'm going to say is that talking about like communicating with teachers and then really trying to figure out how to break down that initial illusion or, you know, issue of like understanding, you know, that the problem that you're dealing with is deal with the bull, that it is, you know, something you can handle. I've seen many different ways of trying to figure out how to break down that barrier of like of seeing it as an illusion. I guess I'm not really going to ask you like what's the best way, but like what would you say would be a good practice from the standpoint of a teacher talking to a student to kind of start breaking down that barrier?
What I found, and even with when I had patients with kids and all that, they would tell me certain things, and I would, just knowing what I found through the sabotage, I'm going to go back to the sabotage and trade again in the antidote. Once I understood who they really were, and I was able to use that antidote for them, whether or not it was a teenager or an adult, something innately just triggered them to a point of saying, yeah, this is exactly what I do. You understand me. And once you feel, whether or not you're an adult or a teenager, someone understands you, you'll slowly open up and start trusting them, because now you understand, you know, deal with that. You know, why are many counselors, especially drug and alcohol counselors, that went through all that? They were alcoholics and addicts and all that. They can relate so much to that person. So one of the things that teenagers are definitely turned off of, and we were that way too when we were teenagers, that someone pretending to know what we're going through. Even though they went through it, you can just kind of go around it and go, man, I don't know what you're going through, but I can listen, or something like that. And that, I remember one time I was in college, and I had a really bad time. A lot of things were happening. I just flipped out. And one of my friends just walked in and says, I don't know what you're going through, but I can listen. That was the only thing he could have said to me at that moment in time. And I sat and I relaxed, and we talked for like 5 o'clock in the morning. And he helped me by just listening and letting me vent.
And see, you talk about the importance of talking to a teenager, the importance of talking to somebody that's trouble and listening to what they're saying before you react. That's a key component that a lot of people already judge what that teenager is going to say, and they overreact, which causes them to get upset and teaches them to fly, to fly away, to flight and not. And they don't want to fight. They want to flight. They want to leap. And so when you do that, you lose the opportunity to build that relationship so that you understand why they did something. It cracks me up when I hear certain comments my wife might say about my children and our children. And I say to myself, you know, you probably did the same things. I know I did the same things. Overreaction's not going to work. You have to accept that kids are not perfect. And most kids, even if you think they're perfect, other kids that you might know that are, you know, friends of the family or different people, really they're the same as your children. You just aren't living under their roof. Right, Dr. Phillips?
Right.
That's the real key.
Well, I'm so cool how we're really really thinking on the same level. You know what's really cool? Why do you get upset with anybody? because they're doing exactly what you're doing that you don't want to see. How dare you show me a part of me that I've been running away from, and that's why you're angry. 100% of the time. And I've had people look at me and go, there's no way. And I would talk with them, and they, at the end, they would go, oh, my God, it is true. Because what happens is, you know, I can say 1 in 3. There's no argument, unless you got something wrong with your brain. There's no argument between 1 and 3. However, if I say horseless Bucky and I say car, we can argue that we're talking two different things until I show you each of us a picture, right? Words have different meanings. So I can say one word to you that can have a total different meaning than another word, which is synonymous to that same word. So I can say one word, and you're disagreeing, and I can shift into a synonymous word, and you go, oh, yeah, that's it. We're saying the same thing. It's just changing the word and what that word is meaning to you. And mainly, the reason why we are upset is because they're showing a part of us that we don't are not dealing with.
You know, and it's so vitally important, you know, as has been said, that, you know, keeping the lines of communication open as much as possible, leaving the ability to, you know, vocalize what's going on, you know, not straight out saying, you know, I think I know what you're going through, or I know what you're going through, things like that. You know, it's really important. And what I'm thinking is, like when those two particular situations come around, because I've dealt with my own set of assisting kids in different types of programs, and I'm just curious because, you know, there's different ways of handling this. And of course, obviously, you know, if you're not qualified, or if you're not, so to speak, if you're a teacher, but you need to pass someone off to, like, let's say a school psychologist or something like that. How does that, like, initial process happen where, like, let's say, you know, you're talking to a student, it gets really, really heavy, but you don't want to necessarily just pass them off to someone else because they're not going to trust, or they might not trust the next person, as well as, you know, the thing is they're talking to you, and, you know, their connection is just so ingrained in talking with you specifically, depending on the situation. How would that work to not only continue to keep those lines of communication open, but also to make sure that those barriers stay down, and that the overall illusion or the overall issue that's happening is still seeable as controllable and as takeoverable by the person, you know, when they get up to that certain point?
Well, one of the things that people have to realize is that there's a difference between control and influence. If I'm trying to control, first of all, we have no control over anybody except ourselves.
Right.
I can have influence. So as we're talking, maybe you had one thought process, and through a conversation you and I have, I can influence you into my thought process. Compared to me going, look, man, if you don't do this, you're out of your mind. This is going to happen to you. And that's controlling and manipulating. And that's what sometimes maybe a teacher or adult to a student or teenager scenario happens. And a lot of times, by just saying, what do you think you need to do? Or if we were switched in roles and you were telling me and I was you, what would you tell me I need to do? And if you didn't have the knowledge and the expertise of that, because I really care about you, and I would never want to say something to tell you to do something or suggest something to you that would cause you to go down the wrong direction. That's why I would think, you know, Mrs. or Dr. Jones or Mrs. Jones or whatever, a psychologist or a psychiatrist, whatever, would be probably the best thing for you. Wouldn't you agree? And then asking that question, not going, you got to do this or you're nuts. Even
right.
though you've been through that, you can't say, yeah, I've been through that. You can go, I've been through that. However, may I ask you, can I make a suggestion that what I would have do if I was in that situation?
Exactly.
Now you're depersonalizing it for them. You're not trying to tell them what to do. You're just giving a suggestion.
Well, we appreciate you coming on the program. Best of luck, and look forward to coming on another one of my programs as well to talk about another topic. So thanks again for calling. All right, take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. When we get back, another guest, Peter. You know, we're just kind of switching things up. We'll be back in just a moment. We're back to Total Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh. And we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT. And I'm with my co-host, Peter Elvidge. And our next guest is going to always, we have interesting guests. So I'm excited to welcome the program. I know my producer says we have her on the line. Give us 1 second. I love when we wait to see. I think we have. We do have on the line Susan Shumsky. Susan, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm great. How are you tonight, Neil?
I'm doing fantastic, and my co-host Peter's excited to talk to you as well because you're going to talk about the value of education. And, you know, here, I'm going to give you a world view before we go into this topic in further detail, Susan, is the world, or I guess a point of view of what I see. And before I was an educator, before I became a teacher, I was a professional wrestler. I was a college student. I was working at a credit bureau, but I never, ever saw the value of education, that the more I tried to learn things, the better I would become. But once I became an educator and I saw education as a tremendous value, even though a lot of the things I do today, even though I still tutor, is involving business and many different things, always I'm looking for the opportunity to learn. And that is when it shows what education is the most powerful team. I have an unbelievable team of people, and every one of them is a lifelong learner that wants to constantly learn. So that's what we're missing, Susan, in our lives in the U.S. and some places in the world, is education is missing.
Well, I don't know if I would agree that education is missing, because right now we have something called the Internet, and this is the biggest proliferation of knowledge ever in the history of humanity. We can just, from our own bed, we can study any subject, we can go to school, we can learn anything, we can see any art, literature, music, cinema, we can become creative ourselves and create anything, including writing, filmmaking, photography, podcasting, so on and so on. So I would say that there's never been a more educated humanity ever.
All right, Peter, you got a question for her out there right off the bat. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is something I definitely, like, when I was in school, and then also I'm coming back and doing some educational classes and things right now myself, I've always found that, you know, because, like, if you look at education by itself initially, you just see the grand scheme of, you know, having to go to school, for instance, going and learning and things. I've always found that if you find, like, a passion that you absolutely love, and then think about, like, you know, well, school or class is just another version of learning how to do that passion better. It tends to motivate people to be more educated and to look into education a little bit more, and kind of seeing it instead of it just being, so to speak, a, you know, run in, get your degree and run out kind of thing. It's more of like a, hey, I'm running in and I'm getting more empowered in myself to do this awesome thing when I'm done, and then I'm going to go out and just, you know, totally rock whatever my passion is. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, with today's technology, I mean, we're even more empowered, as you said, to do this.
I love what you just said. I absolutely love it, because our passion, our purpose, why we're here on Earth, that's the most important thing for us to discover. And then once we discover that, once we feel incredibly motivated to become the best we can be in that field, we have the opportunity to do that now more than ever before, especially for women and other populations that seem to, let's say, not have the advantages. Now, more than ever before, for example, women, the statistics tell us that there's greater literacy rates amongst women than there's ever been before. And, for example, in 1950, 56% of the world's population can read and write. And in 2009, the figure rose to 84%. And the most dramatic improvement was in young women. In South Asian females, only half of them were literate in 1990, and now more than 75% are. So I would say that education is enjoying an incredible explosion, and our passion is what is driving this. No matter
what your passion is,
you can find that on the internet, and you can just immerse yourself in it now.
And that's true. And so I get, like, my story, and there are different ways, a lot of things I learned today is through the internet, through researching, looking at things, and becoming better, where before the internet, Susan, that was impossible for some people to find that info.
Yeah, you'd have to go to a library like I did. I mean, you know, I'm 7 years old, and I spent quite a bit of time before the internet in libraries researching different things. Especially since I was writing books, I had to do the research. So I would have to go to the library. I'd have to look through the articles, for example, get the microfilms. I mean, it was a big thing to even do research back then. The youngsters today, they're so lucky. They don't have to do all that work. In just 1 second or less, they can find any article they want about any subject. This is a very exciting time that we're living in.
You know, and it most definitely is, because there's so many different types of pieces of technology that you can just access multiple different things, multiple different ways. Like, I mean, for instance, if you're an audio learner, you can, you know, view things via audiobooks and, you know, using your phone, for instance. It's crazy. We have computers in our pockets now. It's definitely encouraging, and definitely to myself, being, you know, having blindness, I definitely have been empowered by technology and definitely been able to learn and be more educated and do more incredible things. I've found, and this is an interesting question I was thinking of, is I found that, you know, as we continue to progress and we're looking at the grand scheme of what education is, I mean, do you really see, like, instead of our educational system being seen as a, you know, you walk in, you get your degree, and you walk out, turning into something completely different in the next few years because of the major transitions we are from a traditional classroom to, you know, kind of a whole bunch of different styles of classrooms because of the advances in technology?
Well, let me get out my crystal ball here and try to figure the answer to that question out. The reality is that there are many different kinds of learners, as you brought up. Some are more visual, some are more auditory, some are more kinesthetic. Those are the three major ways that we are learning. And the kinesthetic types of learners are going to want to go to a class. And this is true even in my field, which is the holistic field. Not everyone can learn from reading one of my books. Many people would rather come to a class. I personally enjoy learning from going to a class and immersing myself in that class with a live teacher. So I don't think that live teachers are going to disappear anytime soon, although there is a lot more live teaching on the internet through streaming and also through videos. So that is entirely possible, but still I think people are going to want to come in groups and to be able to discuss with each other and learn in that way. I think personally it's the best way for me to learn. Other people might be different. If they're more of an auditory learner or a visual learner, then they may or may not want that, the live kinesthetic experience.
Interesting. And so when we get back, we're going to kind of delve more into this holistic type learning, to define what holistic learning is and how, even in classrooms, let's say, you know, elementary school teachers or high school teachers can implement some of that holistic sense to their teaching and look at that learning process. You're listening to Whole Education Hour on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh, and we're streaming live at WRCT.org, #WRCT. When we get back, we're going to be back with with Dr. Susan, and also Peter Eldridge will be back in just a moment. We're back to Total Education on 88.3 WRCT in Pittsburgh, and we're streaming live at WRCT.org, hashtag WRCT, and I'm with Peter Eldridge and Dr. Susan Chomsky, and we're on talking about specifically enough the age of education, how it's changed. She described me right off the bat, Susan. I love it in that way that I still think that we're not valuing education, but we're seeing educate because of the World Wide Web, because of technology, people are becoming better learners. You're seeing more literacy in specific areas. You're seeing more improvement in certain areas of people wanting to learn. Now, let's define holistic education. Is that because, again, that's, again, one of your expertise, Dr. Susan. Define that for me.
Well, there's a lot of ways we could define holistic education. I mean, we could define a Waldorf school as holistic education, different types of styles of education as holistic. But specifically in my case, I'm teaching holistic subjects like education, intuition, the kinds of things that you don't necessarily learn in school, things that will help you to become more self-sufficient and self-empowered, because when a person has to face situations and challenges in their life, it isn't necessarily the book learning or the intellectual learning or their IQ even that's going to help them to overcome that challenge or to be able to cope with that challenge. For example, tremendous stress, PTSD, all types of challenges that people have in their life. So what I bring to the field of education, and what many like me, many colleagues, many different people who are in this field, metaphysical field, holistic field, whatever you want to call it, we're bringing a different kind of education. And that's an education where you become self-reliant, where you learn how to listen to the inner voice, where you learn how to connect with your own higher self, which is your true inner nature, the true self that we don't necessarily know that we are, because people identify themselves with something that is not necessarily who they really are. So when you develop your ability to be in contact with your true self through meditation, through developing your intuition, then you're able to cope with life easier. You're able to make decisions with confidence because you know you're making the right decision. You're using your intuition to make decisions as well as your intellect. So it's a different kind of sphere. It's an added bonus to the education that we have in schools today. Although there are some schools that are starting to incorporate meditation. In fact, I think you've even covered that on this program in the past.
Yes, I have, with Dr. Susan Power. Susan Power, I had her on for that, but you're right, meditation in mm-hmm. schools and all that. So, Peter, question four, to continue this conversation.
Yeah, so, and correct me at any time if I'm wrong, but so the way that I'm kind of seeing it is that the way that classes are more presented, it's not that it's less, like, you know, so to speak, traditional education bound. It's got more, I would say, elements of psychology, breaking barriers down in both a physical and spiritual way. And I'm just curious, like, you know, when you're initially doing classes, you know, which whatever type it is, how are you kind of like presenting, so to speak, those open roads where people can get to the point of, like, for instance, breaking down one of the barriers, learning how to control their stress, things like that? How do they get from point A to point B, so to speak?
Yes. The thing is that through meditation, which I'm a tremendous advocate of meditation, and also yeah. of affirmation and other holistic methods that are taught by some people on this planet that aren't necessarily professors in school, it's being taught on the fringes, shall we say. So what I do is help people to learn how to meditate, meaning relax, get quiet, get still within, and to be able to actually connect with that inner voice, the voice of truth within. Every one of us really has an incredible reservoir of intelligence, of creativity, of wisdom, and it's right here within us. It's within our own being. And people from the East might say that it's contained within our energy field, shall we say,
our subtle
energy body or whatever. But even if you believe that or don't believe that, it doesn't matter. Meditation will still work for people as long as they take up a practice that helps them. And the practice may be different for different people. Some people may find that they're able to center themselves through using for example, a mantra as it is used in transcendental meditation, or just praying or calling upon a divine being, taking deep breaths. Some people, they just take deep breaths, and that helps them to get quiet and calm and still within. Some people use some form of exercise like yoga postures, something like that, or other yogic practices. Those can be very helpful. Something called bandhas, which are muscular locks. Something called pranayama, which is breathing exercises that help to calm people down. Even taking a walk in the woods, being outside in nature, can be a meditative experience for a lot of people. You don't necessarily have to sit down and close your eyes in order to experience that calmness within. But the calmness within is really key to being able to cope better with your life, to be able to face the challenges of your life, to be able to make the best decisions, to be able to be calm in instances when you're being challenged, you're being attacked verbally or something like that, or even physically attacked. That calmness can help even in that kind of situation. But mainly, it's something that makes people happier. So
yeah,
I think happiness is really key.
Let's talk about, you know, meditation helping the brain so you think better in education. The more silence you spend each day at times, the more meditative you are at certain times of the day, the more you're going to better perform in your job, the more you're going to be better in your in the classroom. Different things. If we're constantly yakking and constantly never taking a break away from everything in our environment, what happens to us?
Well, stress happens to us. Stress leads to hypertension. Hypertension leads to disease. The kinds of disease like heart disease, the kinds of disease like diabetes, the kinds of disease that will kill people. So in order for us to avoid these kinds of consequences, and in this society where it's, you know, so busy all the time, it's even more important for people to take time to be quiet, even if it just means taking an hour to sit in your bathtub and relax. That can be a meditation for people. So it's important for us to take time for ourselves. And time for yourself will be different for different people. Some people will really groove on music, for example. There may be some kind of music that makes them just chill, just feel quiet, or taking that walk outside in a very inspiring place, taking a hike maybe, or doing some exercise. Some people find that it's relaxing for them if they go out and run around the block, you know. Different people have different needs. It's important for us to find the way that will help us to relax, to help us to become more centered, more balanced. For me personally, it's meditation. Meditation is what always brings me back to center. It helps me to relax if I'm feeling frustrated, if I'm feeling out of sorts. So I just sit down for a few moments. It doesn't even take more than 5 minutes for me to come back to center. It's so simple and easy to just, for example, take some deep breaths, perhaps call upon a divine being according to your own religious beliefs, maybe say an affirmation, In fact, I could give you an affirmation if you're interested that might be very helpful for people when they're in a stressful situation.
What's a good affirmation when you're stressed?
Yeah. So this affirmation I'm going to give you is called a self-authority affirmation. And it will help in any situation where you might feel out of sorts, or you might feel challenged, or you might feel intimidated. Maybe you have to go to an intimidating interview, or you're nervous about a test that you have to take, or perhaps you're being put upon by people around you who are putting pressure on you, or you feel that you're being abused even verbally, for example. So the best thing to do is just go somewhere by yourself so that nobody's going to listen to you. You can even go into the lavatory or someplace if you're at work. And then just say this affirmation, and this is being recorded, so you'll be able to write this down later. So here it goes. I am in control. I am the only authority in my life. I am protected by the light of my being. I close off my aura and body of light to all but my own higher self. So that's the affirmation right there.
Wow.
And it's very powerful. It really works. It really, really works. Trust me. I've been using this since 1986. I use it just about every day, probably more than once a day. And I have found that anytime I'm in a situation where I feel a little bit off kilter, that will bring me right back to center.
All right, Peter, question for
her. Yeah. So I'm definitely one of those people that is a music listener to, like, relaxation, and figuring out different music at different times helps me. But something I was curious about is intertwining the idea of audio signals with education. So there's so many of these applications out there that right now, for instance, for iPhone, where, you know, you can learn different things by relaxing and hearing, you know, different types of sounds, or maybe some mantras, things like that, that are based around, like, for instance, better at remembering and all these different things. I mean, what do you have to say on these? Are these legitimate? Are they kind of borderline? Are they more so discounted? I mean, what are your thoughts on this?
My thoughts are, I think it's good for people to experiment and see if it works for them. I don't know that there's been any scientific research on it yet, but if it works for somebody, I say do anything that works for you. And if it can relax you, great. I don't know that you'll necessarily get educated by any of these kinds of things, but it may help to relax you, or it may open you up to areas of your brain that are not normally getting exercised, shall we say. So it could be helpful. I think it's a good idea to experiment with it and see how you feel. The question is, after you've listened to that, do you feel more centered? Do you feel more relaxed? Or do you feel like you're out of your body? Do you feel spaced out? Or do you feel grounded? Do you feel like yourself? I wouldn't really recommend things that take you out of your body and make you feel weird and like you're on another planet. Because believe me, in all my experience in the holistic field for the last 50 years, I have actually experienced that, where I'll go into some weird thing and I'll hear this music and then I won't even be in my body anymore. It's like, what happened?
Oh my gosh.
This is no good. I better do that self-authority affirmation now. I am in control.
So
I am the only authority in my life.
So I think this is something for everyone to think about when you're talking about the stresses that are happening in the classroom today and all these different things. And the day-to-day grind of parents and the day-to-day grind of teachers and administrators, they should look to meditation. And you've educated us tremendously in the power of meditation and affirmation. And daily affirmations can be anything that's positive. It's going to give you a lot more of a stronger outlook on more difficult times or different things that are happening, like when people are all against you, or you're having a certain situation, or you don't feel great about yourself at that time. Say one of those affirmations, and I think that's something that students need to be taught to do, especially in this environment of bullying.
I think the most important thing is for people to realize that their words their thoughts and their words have much more power than they think. There was in the scripture called the Dhammapada, in the very first verse of the first chapter of that scripture, which was written by Buddha long ago, ancient scripture, it is said that everything that we are is the result of what we have thought. Now, that is a stunning statement. He said, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. And then he goes on in the next couple verses. He says, if a person speaks or acts with a pure thought, then happiness follows him or her. If a person speaks or acts with an impure thought, then unhappiness follows him or her. So what he's saying there is that we are actually creating our own destiny. We are responsible for our own destiny, because he says all that we are is the result of what we have thought. That's both individually and collectively, by the way. So every one of us is creating day by day our own destiny through every thought, every word, and every deed. So if we go around all day long saying things like, oh, I'm so unhappy, I'm so poor, I'm so sad, I'm so miserable, oh, I'm so fat, we go around saying that over and over and over and over every day in our minds or complaining to other people, guess what is going to manifest in our life? Exactly what we have been saying. But if we go around saying, I am joyous, I am fulfilled, I am prosperous, I am my perfect size and weight, I am loved, I am happy, I'm content, I am peaceful. If we say these kinds of things, that is absolutely going to manifest in our life. So our words have tremendous, tremendous power. It's very important that anytime you use the words, I am, that what you say after you say that those words is something that you truly want to own. And I think that that one principle, if it could be proliferated, if people could learn that one simple principle of how to speak consciously things that you really want to manifest in your life, and take out of your vocabulary things that you don't want to manifest in your life, people are going to be happier, they're going to be more fulfilled, and they're going to fulfill their true purpose in life.
Definitely true in so many ways. And thank you again for calling the program. And really, really interesting stuff you were able to bring to the table. All right, Peter, so kind of to close off the whole show, it's just an interesting process, what we learned from Dr. Susan today, and how it really relates to education. And even with Dr. Philip, the same thing. Both got people came in with an education background to a point, how we relate it to the classroom teachers, parents, administrators, and how much it's our own thoughts that control our actions, Peter.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, education is one interesting being. It can be us. It can be, you know, what we say, what we do, and it can also be what we don't say and what we don't do. And it's really been an interesting conversation on multiple different areas. So I appreciate definitely the guest that came today.
All right. Well, thanks for calling, Peter. We'll talk next week.
All right. Have a good one.
All right. That was Peter Elvidge. Take care, guys. We'll talk next week.